This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 16, Composed Salads. Podcast found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. Today we are going to be talking about composed salads, which will be bringing this whole last two episodes full circle. Because the beauty of a composed salad is it's composed on a plate. But the difference is, when you look at a traditional salad that's served family style, it's usually just mixed greens, sometimes dressed, sometimes not. A lot of times, the dressing is served on the side, and a couple of just very basic accoutrements, right, where you're talking maybe some wedges of plum tomato, some stale bread, or like we call it in the restaurant industry, croutons, and maybe a couple of seasonings here and there, some cheese, some meat, whatever you want. But you leave it up to the diner or your family members or your customer to make the salad how they want. So a composed salad is really taking it to the next level where you're giving them a completed dish, a completed flavor structure that is built from start to finish out of your own imagination and to deliver an impact that a normal family style salad can't do, it can't accomplish. With a composed salad, you're giving them a beautiful piece of work, both flavor structure and also visually on the plate. You're composing that salad, you're putting on garnishes, you're stacking the salad, you're making it look nice and pretty and ready to eat. And so we're going to spend this whole episode talking about composed salads. And first, in our discussion segment, we're going to talk about what is a composed salad and what are some of the common elements. So as we talked about briefly in our intro, the discussion segment is all about what a composed salad is and how it differentiates from a normal salad that you just, you know, kind of throw out there. Like, here's your salad, take it, you know, put on some dressing, put on some ranch, put on some Thousand Island, put on some vinaigrette, I don't care, whatever you want. A composed salad, when you serve it, it's a completed dish. It's a part of you. It's showcasing who you are, and it's a great way to lead off a tasting menu or just your appetizer section on your menu just in general. What you're doing is you're taking these elements and you're taking your experience with flavor structure and knowledge and technique, and you're saying, this is how I want you to eat this salad. These are the flavors that I want you to experience. And in its simplest form, a composed salad is literally a predefined flavor structure done by you, including contrasting seasonings and complementary textural elements. And it's a singular plated salad that's meant to be eaten as a dish. Now, there are a few important components to a composed salad. And really what it comes down to is a composed salad, just like any great dish, is all about flavor structure and textural elements. And you will usually, in a composed salad, have one highlighted or central element, whether it's a protein, like duck confit, or a terrine, or even highlighting the salad itself. I mean, one of the very traditional salads that we do at Stella Restaurant is a composed salad of buttered lettuce. And it's beautiful. We arrange it, and it looks like a nice little flower. We kind of take the larger leaves, set them on the bottom, we build a base, we build it up, and it looks like this beautiful conical sort of lettuce flower. And from there, we build around our garnishes and our complementary seasonings and flavor structure, both with texture and flavor. And that's a very important point to grasp. Now, the accompanying ingredients will be chosen around your one central ingredient. So, for example, with our butter leaf lettuce salad that we serve at Stella, I want to highlight this beautiful, organically grown butter leaf lettuce. Now, butter leaf has a little bit of a crisp texture, especially as you work more towards into the center. You know, the leaves get a little bit lighter and they get more and more crisp. And I want to make sure I'm seasoning those properly. This is one of the few salads that actually I dress on the plate. So what we'll do is we'll take the butter leaf lettuce and we'll build that little tower. You start with the outer cups, and there's going to be some larger, flatter leaves that you don't want to use just because they're flat and they're more like a leafy green. So normally we'll take those and you can turn those into lettuce wraps, or you can make them a part of a sauce, or you can chop them up and use them as an underliner for something else. Chiffonade is a great knife skill technique to thinly slice this lettuce, and you can lay it under your glazed pork ribs or your chicken wings, but you're going to use it as an underliner, right? And you want to use the more inner leaves to compose your salad because it's going to have more structure and it's going to highlight what butter leaf lettuce really is, which is a beautiful, mild, crisp green. And to that, we add our house-made sherry shallot vinaigrette, which is an emulsified vinaigrette using a Dijon mustard as our emulsifier. There's no egg in this. Little bit of nice aged sherry vinegar, some honey to counterbalance that. And we blend it all together in the blender, and it stays emulsified, and we dress this out on the plate by basically separating the leaves and sticking the nozzle of the squeeze bottle in between those leaves and kind of sprinkling around. And the not only does it act as a dressing, but also acts as a seasoning component because, again, butterleaf lettuce is fairly mild. So you want to bring some more flavors to the party. Now, any salad is going to have a nice crunch element to it. And if you're using something like iceberg lettuce or romaine, that crunch is already inherent in the crispiness of those leaves. But even then, it's still nice to add an exterior crunch texture. And nothing's better than a candy nut, whether it's a candied walnut, candied pecan. And so we take candied pecans and we sprinkle those around the outer edge of the plate, which we're going to have a little culinary quick tip at the end of this episode on how to actually candy some nuts. And then I love the taste of fresh tarragon with the butter lettuce and also the sherry shallot vinaigrette. So we pull off nice, large, individual leaves of the tarragon herb, and we intersperse them inside the butter leaf lettuce. They're kind of sticking out like nice little just rays of sunshine coming out of the composed butter leaf lettuce salad. And we finish it off by garnishing it with some orange supremes or little segments that are devoid of seed and pith. And we use a seasonal orange. And some of my favorite oranges is during the wintertime blood orange because it's strikingly visual. It has a dark red flesh. And also, when you transfer a little bit towards late winter into spring, Caracara oranges become available. And I think that's my all-time favorite orange because it's just so floral and almost has this candy-like quality to it. And it just adds this great sort of citrusy and sweet component to the final composed dish. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the supreme technique and also with how to make the sherry shallot vinaigrette that we serve at Stella, I'm going to put links in the episode 16 show notes to both our house vinaigrette and also the knife skill technique on how to supreme out oranges. But as you can see, this salad is simple, and it's there to highlight the wonders that is organically grown butter leaf lettuce. And that's really what a composed salad is. And we're going to get more into this in the technique segment. But suffice to say that every well-done composed salad is going to have one central ingredient. And everything else that you put on that plate, whether it's a textural element or a seasoning or a flavor element, is there to enhance and showcase that one central ingredient. Now, when planning for a composed salad, it's now time to put the last two episodes into action, right? Because we talked about in episode 14, making your green mix, right? Using leafy greens and tender greens, bitter, and the crunchy greens for that textural element. So you can use a mixed green salad, or you can choose to highlight one green. But really what you want to do is you want to work with contrasting flavor elements. And I'm going to go through some of the more common contrasting flavors right now. So number one is sour and tart, right? You have dried cherries, vinaigrettes, citrus. Those all have sour and tart undertones or flavors to them. So you want to bring those into balance, right? If I just served you a big bowl of grapefruit, it, you know, and it's like, what the hell is this? You call this a salad? No, it's not a salad. Even if I took that big bowl of grapefruit and I put it on top of a bed of lettuce and sprinkled it with a nice vinaigrette, it still will not be a composed salad because there's no balance. The grapefruit's going to completely take over that dish. So you want to highlight or contrast that sour or tart flavor with sweetness, because sweet and tart, they go together. Think sweet tarts, yeah? So a good sweetener is honey in your vinaigrette, berries, you know, that are in season and nice and plump, and ripe fruit. You can also, if you want to go the more savory route, you can go caramelized onions. And all these have sweet undertones that are going to counterbalance the tartness. And what's beautiful about this action is that having those two contrasting elements on the plate, the sour or the tart from the citrus of your vinaigrette is going to really draw out the sweetness and the honey. And the sweetness and the honey is really going to draw out some of the flavor aromas and taste from the vinaigrette or your dried cherries or your citrus through balance, right? So you're going to be able to get all the great aspects of those flavors without it taking off in one direction or another and taking over the dish. Another good contrasting play is actually a play on your senses, which is warm and cold. So a warm ingredient could be roasted or grilled meats, grilled vegetables, poached or grilled shellfish, poached fish, poached duck breast, poached poultry. And these can be contrasted with cooling and cold foods. Cucumber is a cooling ingredient. Melon, especially watermelon or honeydew, is a cooling ingredient. Frozen grapes are a cooling ingredient. Now, some people think I'm weird, but I know there's some out there that have done this. Have you ever taken your French fries, you know, and dipped them in your milkshake? You haven't? It's fantastic. And that's basic flavor structure at work. Let's look at the seasoning, right? You got the sweetness of the milkshake that contrasts with the saltiness of the fries. You got the heat of the fries, which contrasts with the saltiness of the cold milkshake. It's really a great flavor pairing. As simple and pedestrian as it is, it highlights the hot and cold, the salty and sweet contrasting of ingredients. Also, if you have tender ingredients like poached fish or, you know, a red leaf lettuce, you want to counterbalance that textural element with crispness, whether it be breadsticks or croutons, fried wonton strips, or another crisp green. You always want to have contrasting textural elements, such as a soft leaf with candied nuts, because it's going to enhance one another. It's going to break it up in your mouth, and you're going to get the nice crunch of the nuts, and you're going to get that satisfying chewiness of the tender greens. Now, there's also rich and fatty, which will contrast with, obviously, lean ingredients. Now, rich and fatty can be duck confit, which duck confit salads are amazing. Bacon lardons, a creamy dressing that has a lot of fat in it. And you want to contrast these with iceberg lettuce, bean sprouts, acidic ingredients, acid that will cut through that fat that coats that palate. Peppery greens, bitter greens, anything that can cut through that fat to allow you to not grow tired and weary of that main ingredient and to have what we call in the industry palate fatigue. Because look at this. I love duck confit. But it's not nearly half as good if you just take a leg of duck confit, you roast up, and you just eat it by itself. Because it's fatty, and it's juicy, and it's ducky, and it's all those, and it's salty, and it's all those wonderful, great things, right? But after the first couple of bites, it becomes tiresome. It becomes one-dimensional on the palate. But if you cut that salt with some sweetness, if you cut that fat with some acid, if you cut the chewiness of the duck with a nice crisp green, then you're going to have a completed dish. And also don't overlook spicy elements, strong mustards, peppers, habaneros, jalapenos, just fresh cracked black pepper. And anytime you add those spicy notes or those peppery notes into your composed salads, you want to cool them and contrast them with ingredients that have a high water content. Melons, cucumbers, lettuce, again, iceberg, romaine. Those all have the ability to cut through the spiciness. Now, also, one of the great flavor pairings of all time is spicy and sweet. In fact, when they came up with the Scoville scale, the way that they would test Scoville units is they would have you eat a hot pepper, then you'd open your mouth, and they'd spray your mouth with a sugar water solution, and the amount of time or the amount of sprays that it took to calm down that heat in your mouth was the Scoville scale. And that just goes to show that sweetness, especially sugar, has a natural way of cooling off heat and hot peppers, especially when structured in a composed salad. So if you want to serve something hot, like some roasted, like some fire roasted jalapenos, would go great in a salad, right? And it'd be a great element, spicy element to something fatty, because fatty and spice is going to give you those two different playing flavors. But to cool down the mouth, you're also going to want something cooling in the dish, likes a sweetness, whether it's the honey in your vinaigrette or maybe a nice sweet melon, any of those things. And going along those lines of constantly looking at flavor structure and balance is going to give you the ability to create a composed salad. So step one is you want to figure out, what do I want to highlight? Do I want to do a butter leaf lettuce salad and highlight the fact that this is a beautiful piece of butter leaf? Or do I want to say, hey, look it, you know, I made some duck confit, you know, back in the cooking series. And, you know, I learned how to make duck confit, and it's been curing out for a month now. And I want to use it. Well, a great way to use it is in a salad. You can highlight it in a salad because you can construct that composed salad to where everything takes a backstage to your duck confit, which is front and center. But every single element that you add is going to highlight that rich, fatty saltiness of the duck confit. Now, there's also composed salads that are more like composed appetizers because they technically don't have any leafy or salad greens in them. Now, one of the things that comes to my mind is a heirloom tomato salad, a beet Napoleon, and also a sautéed spinach salad, which technically has greens in it, but it's a different take because you're sautéing and you're heating it up. Now, for heirloom tomatoes, one of my favorite ingredients in the summertime are some beautiful, ripe, fresh heirloom tomatoes. And I like to keep it simple. I like to slice them, lay them out on a platter. And everything that I serve with those tomatoes is to enhance their flavor. You know, if we're going to go down just the classic route of an heirloom tomato salad, what you want to do is you want to slice up your heirlooms, lay them on a platter, maybe have some tender greens underneath your heirlooms. I like to use mosh, and you can lightly dress those with a sherry shallot vinaigrette or whatever base vinaigrette that you prefer, just a little bit. And then you want to cut the acidity in both your salad dressing and the acidity inherent in the heirloom tomatoes with accompanying ingredients. So you'll often see fresh mozzarella cheese, which has a nice high fat content. Even better is burrata cheese, which is basically the creamy, fatty center of mozzarella cheese. And that fattiness will kind of coat the tomatoes. And when you put it in your mouth and you work them together and you start chewing it together, that fattiness is going to cut through the acid and let you really experience all the subtle, complex flavors that are contained within the heirloom tomato. A little bit of reduced balsamic vinegar is nice because as you reduce balsamic down, it becomes more and more sweet. You can drizzle that over the top. Nice little dose of extra virgin olive oil for both its grassy and floral notes, but also the fat, which again will bring the heirloom tomatoes into balance. And a nice sprinkling of fleur de sel, which is the extremely fragile salt crystals that are skimmed off of French ponds. And they just burst in your mouth with saltiness and sweetness. And that bursting of saltiness and sweetness is really going to highlight the heirloom tomatoes. In the wintertime, I like to do a beet salad. And you can do a Napoleon or a mixed beets. And what I've been doing lately, actually, because we have the wood fire at Stella, is I leave the skin on the beets. And when I'm getting the fire, when I get it burning nice and hot, and I start burning down to coals, because you know I start a fire every single morning to charge the oven hearth with heat so I can bake our bread in it for that night's service. When you pull out those coals, there's no reason to waste them. I mean, you can do this at home with a regular wood-burning oven or wood-burning stove or fireplace. And you take these large chunks of coal. I prefer to use oak. And I'll bury the beets skin on in the coals, and I'll let them roast for about an hour and a half. And what happens is the sweetness of the beets just condenses in, because as they start to cook, they start to release out steam, and the steam goes directly into the coals, and the coals vaporize it. And from here, I don't even actually peel the beets themselves, because the peels have become almost candied. They're so sweet and yet still earthy. And so I'll pull them out of the ashes very carefully, obviously, and wipe them clean with a dry towel. And I'll take my hand and I'll gently press them down. And I'll flatten them out. And I'll serve them with a little bit of a burrata cheese, some candied nuts to have that crunch sweetness component. And dress it with a little bit of a vinaigrette, maybe some nice bitter greens like a frisée underneath. And the brininess and saltiness of capers goes great with this whole dish to kind of finish it off as a garnish. So those are just some ideas, some dishes that I actually execute and serve as compost salads that don't contain greens or very little greens. And really the important thing to comprehend, the number one takeaway that you need to take away from this entire series is flavor, structure, and enhancement. So you need to start looking at what you want to serve. What's your key ingredient? What are you going to highlight? Whether it's beets, heirloom tomatoes, duck confit, butter leaf lettuce, romaine, maybe a great creamy salad dressing. And you want to take all your other ingredients and bring that one ingredient into focus and highlight it. A lot of times I get somewhat confused and frustrated when I go and eat at restaurants. And their whole shtick is complexity, right? Oh, yeah, here's our duck salad, and we cure the duck in a 16-spice rub, and yada, 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 and we have another 15 elements on the plate. It's like, who cares? You know, how self-conscious are you? I mean, really, I don't care how good of a palate you have. I would be amazed if you can pick out four of the 16 spices in that 16-spice rub. Complexity hides flaws. And that's a very important takeaway. You need to be confident in your cooking skills and your ability and your knowledge of flavor structure. And you need to build a dish around one singular ingredient, and every single other ingredient that you put in that dish, its only purpose is to bring that ingredient into focus. Think of a great photograph, right? The photograph is all about the image. It's all about that beautiful sunset or that beautiful tree. the lens, the camera, the aperture setting, the timer, whether you put it on a tripod or not, the f-stop, the lighting, if you're using studio lightings, all those other ingredients or elements that go into making that photograph, their only purpose is to make that photograph look more like itself. It's extremely hard to capture that beautiful sunset in a picture. And only a very, very skilled photographer can actually do that. It's the same thing with cooking. It's very hard to capture the beauty of a singular ingredient. It's much, much easier to be like, oh, yeah, here's this, and here's that, and here's that, and here's this, and here's five different salts, and here's three different peppers, and you mix them all together, and no, you gotta taste this pepper by itself, and you gotta taste that salt by itself, and oh, if you use the cell degree on this watermelon, then it tastes different. If you use, the fleur de sel on the cherry tomato, then it tastes different. It's like, no, stop. Okay, I didn't order the kitchen sink on a plate, okay? I ordered a salad, so give me a salad. So your homework for this episode is to create your own unique composed salad using everything we learned over the last two episodes, your mixing of the greens, your contrasting flavors, your contrasting textures, making either a creamy or a regular vinaigrette. And I want you to use at least two contrasting ingredients that highlight one another. And I want you to pick one central ingredient that will be showcased in your finished composed salad. Now again, just like in the last episode, if you take a picture of this, 50 Stella stars, and we got some really good contests coming up. And if you take a video of your recipe, 100 Stella stars, and just because I'm a sucker for duck confit, and it kind of plays into what we did in our last episode, I'll give you another 50 Stella stars if you do a duck confit salad and you do your own unique take on it. And actually, you know what? In general, if you take a technique that we learned in previous episodes, specifically one of the cooking episodes where we were talking about roasting, poaching, confit, frying, whatever it is, if you take a technique that you learned in one of those episodes and you turn it into a composed salad and you shoot a photo on it, that's worth 100 points. 50 for the picture, 50 for the technique. If you do a video, it's 150 in total. So go out, think about what you want to do, whether it's a fried shrimp salad, whether it's a poached fish salad, duck confit salad, or you can just compose a simple butter leaf lettuce salad using a nice emulsified vinaigrette with some candied nuts. Head on over to stellaculinary.com/form and you can post it there. Or you can also post it in the episode 16 show notes by going to stellaculinary.com/SCS16. So as promised earlier on in this episode, today's culinary quick tip is going to be how to candy nuts. And candy nuts are a great element. They work in many different kinds of dishes, but especially for salads and also for desserts. So this technique can be used for both starting your meal and ending your meal. Because, think of dessert, right, where maybe you're serving a panna cotta or some sort of custard, that nice, smooth, creamy texture. You want a little bit of crunch as a contrasting element, contrasting flavor structure on that plate. And the process for candying nuts is really easy. There's a couple of different ways to do it. I had one person show me where you make a simple syrup, right? And that's a simple syrup is basically just boiling sugar and water together. And you can add in any flavorings too. You can add in some pepper, cayenne, some fresh herbs, whatever you want your simple syrup to taste like. And then you toss your nuts in that simple syrup and you kind of cook them slightly so that syrup sticks to the outer shell of the nuts. And you're going to take those nuts that are coated in the simple syrup and drop them in a deep fryer and fry them around. And they come out really well. In a professional kitchen, it works well because you have the fryer already going. And it's a real quick way to candy nuts. Now, the problem is it absolutely destroys your fryer. So, if you're working a garmanger station in a restaurant and you decide that you're going to, fry some candy nuts, the guy who's working the fry cook for Lion that night is probably going to want to strangle you because you're going to destroy his fryer oil. You're going to turn it almost black because all that sugar dissipates in there. So if you're doing this at home and you want to try this technique, it's a good technique. I mean, it gives you a good finished result. But that's only at home because you don't have to worry about the fry cook strangling you. Now, my favorite technique, which is both clean and efficient and yields a great result, is using powdered sugar and water and turning it into a slurry. And it's very, very simple. So, you know, if I want to candy pecans or candy walnuts, you're going to just take the shelled meat, right? So, I mean, minus the shells. And in a mixing bowl, you're going to mix together some powdered sugar and some water, and you're going to form a slurry. And it should look like a loose paste, okay? I'm not going to give you ratios here because it's not that hard. You know, just put some powdered sugar in the bowl, put some water in the bowl, and whisk it together. It should be a paste. If it's too runny, add more powdered sugar. If it's too thick, add some more water. Now to this, you're going to add just a little pinch of cayenne. And you can add more cayenne if you want your candy nuts to actually be spicy. But I like to add cayenne, just a little tiny pinch for a back flavor, because in small amounts, that cayenne will help cut through the sweetness of the candy nut without actually delivering a spicy punch. And from there, you can add in whatever seasonings you want. I like to keep it simple, though, because if you're adding too many extra seasonings, it's really going to take away from the actual flavor of the walnut or the pecan, right? We were talking about earlier, complexity hides flaws. I would recommend just starting with a great pecan or a great walnut and just simply candying them. You can add in maybe like an herb element or whatever. But once you have that slurry formed with your powdered sugar, your water, a little touch of cayenne, and of course a little sprinkling of salt just for some added seasoning, you're going to take your shelled nuts, whether pecans, walnuts, peanuts, whatever you want to do, and you're going to toss it around with a wooden spatula to make sure they're evenly coated. And then you want to lay them out on a sheet tray lined with a silpat. And a silpat is basically a baking mat that's made of silicone, and you can pick them up at any baking store. And it really is a great device to have in your kitchen. And in this particular preparation, you can't really substitute out anything. If you try and use wax paper or butcher's paper or whatever, there's going to stick because it's candy nuts. They get sticky and caramely. So you want to lay them out on your silpat, and you want to bake them in a 350-degree oven for about 10 to 12 minutes. And you want to check them, though, often. Probably within the first 5 to 7 minutes, you want to take a peek. Maybe take your wooden spoon or spatula, and you want to stir them around because the top is going to caramelize, obviously, faster than the bottom that's in contact with the silpat. So you want to mix them around, spread them back out in an even layer on the silpat, and continue baking them for the rest of the 10 to 12 to 15 minutes that it might take. But the problem is anyone who's toasted nuts knows that they go from perfect to burnt really quick. When you add in the addition of sugar, they go from perfect to burnt even faster. So there's a really, really small window of time because the nuts will even continue to keep on cooking once you pull them from the oven because there's so much heat generated from the oil in the nuts and the sugar in the slurry that even if you pull them from the oven, they're a nice dark golden brown. By the time they cool down, they'll probably be slightly burnt. So you want to pull your candy nuts from the oven just slightly underdone. Not much, you know what I mean? Once you see a nice, even golden brown, then it's time to pull them. And you want to let them cool at room temperature. And from there, you want to store them in an airtight container. And these candy nuts will keep almost indefinitely as long as there's no moisture present in the container. And you can also buy those little silica packets. You know when you go out and you buy like beef jerky, and they have those little packets in the bottom that say, do not eat these. These are not food. Well, those are silica packets, and they absorb any moisture within the packaging, keeping that beef jerky nice and dry. Because if there's any moisture in that package, it's going to soak up in the meat, and it's going to possibly turn the meat rancid, and it's going to give you something that's really not beef jerky. So you can actually order silica packets online, or you can just go out and buy yourself a package of beef jerky and a six-pack of beer and drink the beer, eat the jerky, and then you'll have a silica packet, and it'll be a lot more fun than ordering online. And what I like to do is I like to take these silica packets and place them at the bottom of a container that's has a lid, so it will be nice and airtight. And then I'll place a little segment of cheesecloth just right over the silica, just so it doesn't make my candy nuts taste like beef jerky. And then you can place your candy nuts right on top of that, close them airtight, store them at room temperature in a nice, dark, cool place, and they'll keep for, you know, a month at least, maybe even more. And these are going to be great for garnishing salads, garnishing dessert plates. Candy nuts are always a nice secret ingredient to have in your back pocket. Of cheesecloth just right over the silica, just so it doesn't make my candy nuts taste like beef jerky. And then you can place your candy nuts right on top of that, close them airtight, store them at room temperature in a nice, dark, cool place, and they'll keep for, you know, a month at least, maybe even more. And these are going to be great for garnishing salads, garnishing dessert plates. Candy nuts are always a nice secret ingredient to have in your back pocket. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. Make sure you tune in next episode when we finish our Garmanger series talking about canapés, those fancy little one-bite hors d'oeuvres